This podcast is brought to you by Huawei Technologies. From devices to telecom infrastructure to cloud computing and convergence solutions, Huawei is rethinking every link in the IT chain to deliver a better future faster. Huawei is now offering its Fusion Solar PV solution, a unique approach to integrating, optimizing, and digitizing solar power plants. See how to improve your solar project at Huawei.com. That's HUAWEI.com. We're also brought to you by GTM Squared, our new premium service from GreenTech Media. Our editor-in-chief, Eric Wessoff, just wrote a detailed piece on flow battery companies that is a must-read. And tomorrow on the Interchange podcast, we're going to cover the viability of residential storage. For an absurdly low price, you can get it all. If you want a free one-day trial, send an email to squared@greentechmedia.com. For the week of October 29th, 2015, this is the Energy Gang from GreenTech Media. In this show, a conversation with OPower CEO Dan Yates. OPower started with a very simple business model designed to bring incremental energy savings to utilities. Now it wants to provide software to manage the entire customer utility relationship. We'll talk about why that's not easy. Then we'll discuss the end of retail net metering in Hawaii, and we'll finish with a preview of the upcoming Paris climate talks. I'm Stephen Lacey, a senior editor with GTM in Washington, D.C. Catherine Hamilton is also in D.C., a partner with 38 North Solutions, back from her trip to Abu Dhabi. Right, Abu Dhabi?
Yep, absolutely.
With the World Economic Forum?
Yes, I'm on a council there on the future of electricity.
Does that tie into the, we're going to talk about the global climate talks, does that tie into the COP proceedings in any way?
Yeah, so there are some different points of entry with the COP. So some of the same people that were in my cohort are going to be there and be able to speak to what we were talking about.
In New York City, Jigar Shah is with us. He's the president of Generate Capital and a proud father as of last Friday. How's everything holding up over there, Jigar?
Good, really good. As you can imagine, sleepless times, but fun all the same.
Our guest comes to us from Arlington, Virginia, just across the river, the Potomac River from D.C. Dan Yates is the co-founder and CEO of OPower. We've invited him to talk about the promise and perils of selling software into the utility space. Dan, welcome. Glad to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
I'm curious, what do you actually call OPower these days? I mean, some call you a behavioral efficiency provider. You've evolved. You've called yourself a software as a service company, a utility customer care provider. What's the most accurate description?
And those are all dimensions of what we do. I think of us as the leading cloud software provider for utilities and helping them with everything they do on the customer side of their business.
Let's talk about that customer care aspect, which I think is a really interesting piece of your latest strategy. You and your co-founder, Alex Lasky, call the bill the biggest missed opportunity in this space for cutting costs, improving efficiency, improving the customer utility relationship. You also like to point to the wide gap between expectations about what customers want for their user experience and the reality of what utilities are actually delivering. How big is that gap?
You know, from the beginning of OPower, we created the business to do three things: to fight climate change, to do it using software, and to do it by working with energy incumbents, not against them. And we started the business, as you described it, with a very simple idea, laser focused on energy efficiency, and it fueled our early and rapid growth. And as we've grown, it's given us this very fortunate position to look forward and say, and to see where things are going, and also to have now the cash to invest much more heavily in building the software to help utilities get there. And when we look out, what we see is a future for the utility industry where, in particular, the distribution utilities, the guys who own the grid, and that is a $1 trillion asset, and it is a magic, it's a marvelous, massive machine, that they are in a position where they are evolving, and they are really the pivot point in this entire industry, transitioning from a world where everything was centralized, everything was command and control and regulated, to a world with a lot more decentralization and deregulation. But the market maker and the coordinator, the orchestra conductor, as I like to think of it, is the grid providers. And we sell to those companies. And what they need more and more and more is software that enables them to play this role as a market maker across across all of their constituencies. And where our vantage point is helping them to provide the customer interface to do that. And as you look at how utilities are evolving, their customer care initiatives and their demand management initiatives, they're all blurring together. And that's what we're building is this is a series of core software capabilities, or we call them systems of record, that sit on top of the utility's legacy systems and turn them into 21st century companies in terms of their customer service, their offerings, enable them to cross-sell new services, to do better pricing plans, and to deliver demand management.
So Dan, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time and have argued ferociously on this. I get what you guys have done and think what you've built is extraordinary, but do you really believe that these utilities are doing anything more than blowing smoke at you? I mean, when you think about Exelon's investment in C3, while they haven't actually implemented any of really of those software capabilities, I completely agree with you in everything that you say. I just don't know whether the utility CEOs give a flip about actually delivering this stuff as one of their top three priorities. This always seems to be some sort of regulatory hedge where they're like, well, let's hire Opower so we don't have to deal with those stupid regulators who keep asking us about efficiency.
Yes. I have to disagree with you. I really do see it very differently. I'll give you a couple key examples. First, broadly, we're seeing across all of these utilities a reorganization and the creation of a role that we haven't seen before, which is they're calling increasingly a chief innovation officer or an SVP of innovation. And what we see, while that title is very ambiguous, what we see over and over again across our utility clients now is explicit C-level attention to creating new services and starting to experiment with new business models. And these are some of our buyers, our clients who are doing this are some of them you would expect to be some of the most hardline, entrenched, of the utilities out there. Some of whom are in parallel, suing, litigating the FERC 745 regulation as example, and obviously not on the side of the demand response providers. The reason why they're investing in these chief innovation officers who, when you stand up a C-level role, you have to fund it with enough money to attract real people is because they honestly see that their business is evolving and they can't continue to be the commodity provider in exactly the same form that they have been. That's one example. Another example, more specifically, you look at literally to your question, is this one of the top three priorities? Look at the top four priorities that the CEO of Xcel Energy laid out for his company and for the street. And one of those priorities is verbatim, compete for our customers. He thinks about his business as needing to compete for his customers today. He is still a regulated monopoly, but I can tell you that Xcel Energy has some very large commercial customers who are seriously contemplating leaving their grid and doing their own self-generation, and they have burgeoning solar business. They're fighting or competing with burgeoning residential solar businesses in Colorado and now in Minnesota. So this is a very real thing for these guys. And we have, it's unambiguous. Another customer of ours just approved internally a plan for almost $1 billion of spend over the next 8 years to build what they're calling a customer interaction platform for the exact same reasons. This is well beyond lip service. And the reason why is because they're seeing that they have a very powerful asset, the grid, and they have an opportunity to become, like I described, a market maker. And that's a real business there.
So Dan, utilities have really two major entry points for consumers, outage reporting and billing. And those are two things that I would not consider very positive experience touch points where consumers are concerned. So, you all used to be called Positive Energy before you renamed yourselves Opower. So I'm wondering, how do you turn those negative touch points into a positive experience that will allow a utility to go beyond just the lip service or the ideas from the CIO and into really being able to influence consumers at those touch points?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have a whole map that we call the moments that matter. We look at when utilities have the opportunity to interact with their consumers. And the fact is that they don't have that many opportunities. So the touch points are few and far between, and they're very cherished by the utility as a consequence. But there are, so we have a two-pronged approach, I'd say. One is enriching the communications and the moments where they connect with customers already, and you're right, billing and outage are two of those key moments. The second prong is helping them to strengthen and to manufacture more positive moments that matter, in addition to the core existing ones. So as an example, there is another important moment that matters, which is when you move in and move out. And moving in is right now a pretty ineffective and unpleasant experience in most utility territories. It ought to be a place where you get keyed in, you're introduced to the utility, you're introduced to energy efficiency programs, you're introduced to new pricing plans, and your email is collected, and you begin your digital personalized experience with the utility. We're doing a lot with that. And some of our customers, including competitive market retailers, are very focused for revenue reasons on retaining customers when they move. And we've been able to have really tremendous effect with them in deepening those relationships and collecting more data about their clients.
Dan, I was obviously poking fun earlier, but I think what you guys are doing is fantastic. I just have to try to keep hammering home the point that I'm trying to figure out whether these utility companies really want what you want, right?
Let me give you another.
You know what I mean?
There was a great article just last month about the Clean Power Plan and the utility response to it. The top line of the article was utilities are not fighting the Clean Power Plan, and then the question was, well, why not? And the quotes over and over again from AEP, from First Energy, from some of these big, these big national utilities that are not associated with, historically, with progressive politics and climate change concerns, et cetera, over and over, they're saying this is where the world is headed. Like, this is, we don't have time to fight this anymore. That's the reality today. It was not the reality 10 years ago. It was not the reality when I started O-Power. It was certainly not the reality when you founded Sun Edison. These things have changed. And I'm standing here. I'm on the front lines.
I'm not disagreeing with the things that are changing. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is when you look at what Emery Lovin set down in 1975 around efficiency, and you look at where the Paris negotiations are headed now, what people are saying is if we want to stay below 2 degrees, we have to effectively triple the rate at which we're decarbonizing, making our economy more efficient per dollar of GDP. Right, and your company is squarely in the center of that, not just from an efficiency standpoint, but from actually making a utility company and its relationship with its customer more efficient as well. And I'm just I think your company has done really, really well, and I think you're a bright spot in an otherwise sea of gray. But I'm trying to figure out whether these utility companies are actually committed to the megawatt hour contracts that we keep talking about, or demand response flexibility, or load control flexibility, in the same way that they're dedicated to building even more natural gas peaker plants.
I think if we sat down with the top 50 utility leaders, CEOs of the top 50 U.S. utilities, and asked them, would you put on your top three priority list driving down end customer usage by 30% in the next 20 years, none of them would raise their hands. But if you said, would you put at your top priority list driving the efficiency of your business and adjusting it so that you could simultaneously participate more in the renewable and the higher priced renewable energy future that you see inevitably, and maintain the cost effectiveness of your overall offering to continue to justify your existing grid investments, they would all raise their hands. And then if you followed up by saying, and do you agree that demand management is a critical component to that first priority, they would all raise their hands. That's how it's operating. They aren't getting up there and saying to their legislators, I want nothing more than to triple the efficiency of my system. What they're getting up there and saying is, I want a regulatory infrastructure that allows me to participate in solar, in other renewables, to even potentially participate in distributed generation and distributed storage. And as part of that, I see inevitably and importantly that as costs go up, I want to keep bills down, and I'm going to invest in demand management and new rate structures in order to achieve that.
Demand management is very different from load management. So they're going to want to continue to grow their load, right, as we move to a more electrified future, more EVs, EV penetration. I mean, this is about trying to do more, really do more, but with the same, right?
Right, but this is like but every time we prove through the Grid Edge conference that Green Tech Media has or these other conferences other people have that we have the ability using big data and sensors and the internet and everything to really accelerate climate reduction while reducing people's electricity bills and making the grid more flexible, we're stuck with just pilot projects. And then we have to have these sort of political statements around, yes, we can have our cake and eat it too. And it's like, no, you can't. Actually, you have to want what is in front of you. You have to want to solve efficiency. You have to actually want to do it, and you have to not focus on the other stuff for a second while you actually get this part on track.
Yeah, but you of all people, Jigar, know that this is not necessarily an individual utility problem. This is the way that utilities have been structured for years, and it's a regulation problem. And the regulators clearly around the U.S. are stepping up behind this and enabling some of these changes. So whether or not individual utilities are embracing it like you think they should, I feel like the regulatory environment is changing enough so that we're touching upon that vision.
I couldn't agree with you more, Stephen. I mean, I think if you look at the REV proceedings in New York, it's a very good window into where things are beginning to head. You can't go to a utility executive in today's regulatory environment and say, you have to want to not concern yourself with earnings and you have to want efficiency. He's like, I'm sorry, that's not my job. I was put here to protect shareholder value. I have to want to deliver earnings and I will work modestly to evolve the regulations in order to survive. But if you want to radically evolve the regulations, please go talk to a legislator and tell them what you think. And then when you go and look, so then that is the following question. So how is that evolving? And there are bright spots. And the good news is that the utilities are not fighting that. And they're saying, in fact, many of them are pushing their regulators and legislators, just like I said, around the Clean Power Plan, and saying, look, this is inevitable. I'm going to comply with what you've put out. And actually, in a lot of cases, can you please hurry up and help me evolve my business faster? Because I'm getting eaten alive by disruptive entrants. And so you look in New York at what's happening there. We're actually doing a lot of new things that are beginning to help these utilities evolve their business. In fact, I'll tell you know one of the things we have a product, a new solution that we're launching next week. We're rolling out an announcement around it, and it's a marketplace suite. And what it does is in partnership with Enervee, which is the world's leading company dedicated to aggregating information about EE products, is we actually are embedding a marketplace of efficient solutions into our platforms. So showing up on our web features and when you connect into the utilities website, also showing up through our outbound communications. And this is promoting new offers and services. And this is something that REV wants to see because they want to see these grid operators turn into marketplace providers. And that is a profitable future.
There's a shift that I want to talk about that you outline in your 2014 earnings report that I thought was really important. And you decided that you're not going to get into the deployment of smart thermostats after some experimentation there. You said that the thermostat has become entirely a consumer business. What do you mean by that?
Tying back to what I said earlier in terms of what we've done well as a company, we've been very successful when we focused on having an impact on climate with software, working with the utility, with the incumbents, with the utility providers. And we thought that this thermostat initiative, building thermostat application software on top of partner hardware, could be a piece of that for us. And what we've learned is just that what I'm about to say is obvious to everyone, but it's evolved this way in the last few years. It's just 100% of the thermostats are being sold direct to consumer through retail channels, whether it's a Nest or a Honeywell thermostat or any of the other providers. They're being bought in Home Depots and online and through Amazon, and we're just not as a business set up to compete in that environment. When we aspired to enter that market, we had a point of view that there was going to be a meaningful percentage of the thermostats that would actually be cross-subsidized as efficiency offerings through utilities. And what we've seen is that just hasn't materialized in the way that we expected. And as a consequence, the utilities have played a much smaller role in smart thermostat rollouts than we had hoped.
So you've gone from efficiency to behavioral demand response, which we didn't really get to touch on much, to digital engagement, to this customer care and billing. You say you want to get deeper into outage management, potentially other services that are related. I want to sort of wrap up with a question that we've been asking of other companies and that we've been asking of ourselves. And I ask this with the understanding that building software is way different from deploying hardware and manufacturing hardware and deploying stuff. But we've been wondering whether companies like where Sun Edison is at, SolarCity, whether they're trying to do too much and expand too widely rather than trying to do one or two things really, really well. And you're obviously expanding pretty widely in the intelligent efficiency space. Do you worry at all about the risk that you're doing too much or that investors won't understand the business if it gets too diverse?
Not at all. In fact, I think the example that we just talked about of powering down, pun intended, our thermostat business was exactly to that end. We felt like it was distracting, and it was taking our eye off the ball and focusing on what's core to our business. If you look at what you just rattled off, Stephen, behavioral demand response, energy efficiency, digital engagement, Bill Advisor, these are merchandised solutions that are all running on the exact same technology stack. We have built one single platform, which is a customer engagement platform. It's a single analytic layer. When we deploy those four solutions for an individual utility client of ours, we will use the same data integrations for the first product as for the second, third, and fourth. So we get total reusability of all of our connections into the utility data systems. We then run the same personalization layer, and then we have designed these products that are implementations of customer experiences on top of this technology. We have committed to a tremendous focus in the last few years. We're not doing anything other than that. And all of our R&D investment right now is about strengthening the existing technology componentry that we have. I'll give you an example. Our digital engagement solution, we just launched a new version of our technology it's the core of our web capabilities. And we just replatformed the entire solution on this new platform we call NextWeb. What we're doing now is we're just extending the value of NextWeb to our clients, and soon we'll be standing up in front of them and saying, hey, look, just run your whole website through us. But that's not going to be a new distracting product line. It's just an ambitious expansion of our existing capability. And we're committed to that. These kinds of enhancements or the evolution of our business, very focused on those, on this single platform for years.
There's a lot of debate about whether utilities are going to control the customer relationship deeper in the home as third-party energy providers start eroding that relationship, whether they're going to be the ones to lead home energy management. You guys are firmly coming down on the side of the utility. Do you think the utility is still going to dominate that area?
I think it's going to be a yes and. I don't think utilities are going to dominate for things like home energy management inside the home. I think you've got Samsung buying smart things and with 100 devices, and Google buying Nest with theirs, and the utilities are just absolutely will be at a loss trying to compete with those technology titans trying to gain the consumer's choice within the home. What the utility has, and this is what I feel both so deeply passionate about, because I think it is an environmental mandate. It is a must for us to drive to a clean energy future quickly. Utilities have the grid, and the climate change challenge of our era is getting to clean energy fast and cheaply. It is a political and economic issue, not a technological issue. We could do it today, but we don't feel like we can afford it. And the grid makes the transition affordable. Our customers own the grid, and I do believe, and this is, if you're going to debate me on something, it would be this, and I feel like quite confident I will win this debate. I believe the grid is here to stay. Will the grid potentially only serve 85 or 95% of the customers and not the 100% it serves today? Maybe, but it certainly won't only serve 25%. And I've tethered my company and our future to the grid, and to making them and their businesses successful. And I firmly believe that if we can help them accelerate to offer new services, to get more deeply involved in distributed generation and storage and pricing schemes and all of these things, and do it through the customer experience, that we will help drive this clean energy future faster.
Dan Yates is the co-founder and CEO of O-Power. He joined us from their headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. A great conversation. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, guys. Really, really invigorating and a lot of fun to be on with you guys.
Let's quickly pause here to talk about our sponsor, Huawei Technologies. Huawei is a leading global information and communications technology provider operating in 170 countries. Huawei's new product, Fusion Solar PV, combines cutting-edge IT technologies and power electronics to digitize your solar power plant. Optimize investment, reduce maintenance costs, increase power generation, and boost the rate of return of your solar project with Huawei's Fusion Solar PV solution. Learn more at Huawei.com. That's Huawei.com. Huawei, building a connected world of endless possibilities. We haven't talked about net metering in a while, so let's do that. Last week, the Hawaii Public Utilities Commission made the decision to end the current net metering program in the state. Under new rules, which apply to newly installed systems, solar customers will get paid the wholesale rate for electricity fed back into the grid rather than the retail rate. There's also this self-supply option, which prevents customers with storage systems from feeding more than just a little trickle of electricity back into the grid, but it speeds up the permitting and approval process. So we could see more self-consumption in the state. There's also a $25 minimum bill for customers feeding solar into the grid to pay for fixed costs. Naturally, this has created a whole lot of controversy. Those worried about unsustainable growth in Hawaii's solar industry, including many within the solar industry, say it was time for a change. The many national solar companies that are represented by the Alliance for Solar Choice are furious, and they're now suing the PUC over the decision. Marco Mangelsdorf, who is a solar installer and energy expert in Hawaii, who actually supports the changes, said, quote, "This could be the first domino to fall, with more states conceivably ending their net metering programs." Jigar, we knew in this recent track that this was coming. What do you think about these two new alternatives to net metering in Hawaii?
Well, just to maybe respond, to Marco's question first, this is not something that's trending across the country. I mean, I definitely think that net metering is sort of quote unquote under siege across the country. But this notion that net metering in the continental United States and net metering in Hawaii are comparable is crazy. I mean,
just because Hawaii has so much penetration and is facing completely different problems.
It's just crazy. And on top of that, when you think about what Hawaii has moved to, Hawaii's wholesale power prices are not 4 cents. Hawaii's wholesale power prices are 14 cents or 18 cents, depending on where you are.
Yeah, I think they're like 15 cents on average, right?
Right. So, I mean, it's like that's actually a pretty good deal. And then when you think about the no net export piece, option, which is a self-supply option, that's actually exactly where you would do demand shaping, right? So you could imagine you actually start to control the demands of the like refrigerator, let's say, and say, hey, why don't you do your cooling during the day when the solar is available as opposed to doing it at night, right? And so there's a lot of these other opportunities to do demand shaping. And so, look, I think Hawaii has made a really bold choice. I definitely think that the task folks were led to believe that they were on track to doing a deal on net metering, and this took them by surprise, and so I think they're furious. And I definitely think that this is sort of a, like, split the baby in half, which is, sort of a horrible way of saying it, because I don't think this actually is good for HECO, because it doesn't really solve their problem. And I don't know this is bad for the solar industry, so it's not going to really, cut off demand on that side. So, like, I think it's like a suboptimal solution.
I spoke last night with Commissioner Lorena Kiba, and she's been very big on storage. And so I feel like this is, and I agree with Jigar that this is a special circumstance because of the way the state is constructed. But this is really good for storage. I mean, this allows consumers to take advantage of storage, demand response, efficiency, smart technologies, smart home packages and aggregation in a way that they haven't been able to before, and in a way that they were just completely stuck in a situation that was was really untenable and unsustainable for the state. So I feel like this is like a, going a step in the right direction because they're going to allow a lot more services in.
A lot of the storage is going to be suboptimal, right? You can imagine if someone says, oh, here's a storage system that allows you to bypass the HECO rules for the next big thing and allows you to do self-supply, et cetera. That doesn't mean that storage is going to be available to be bid into the to a market for HECO to use for grid stability services. And so all of the other benefits that actually pay for storage, this is basically just a tax using storage. It's saying, look, if you tax solar PV systems with storage, we'll actually allow you to install systems. But it's not actually mandating that the storage be unified in some sort of standards approach with the utility, such that the utility can use all this virtual storage and real storage in a distributed fashion to manage the grid better.
Isn't that what the PUC is trying to figure out, though? I mean, they've made it pretty clear that they want to establish those rules.
Yeah, but not through this. All of the benefits of having storage are going to be lost in this because they haven't defined them. And then we can say, what, 2 years from now, well, now going forward, all projects have to meet some standards. So all the people who install solar plus storage in the next 2 years are going to maybe potentially not meet the standard or have to retrofit their units to meet some sort of communication standard. It's literally the worst possible, you know, chaotic thing they could have done.
It takes a long time to put those rules into place. Are you saying that they should have just kept net metering as it was?
No, I'm saying they should have hired Catherine, who already put all these rules in place 10 years ago. This is not something that hasn't been done before. The Gridwise Alliance, all sorts of other people have talked about these things. Energy Storage Association, you know, they've been doing a pilot with SolarCity that SolarCity finally, like, you know, rejected at the end because they had contract issues with HECO. But 95% of this conversation has already been completed. The PV technical group has been working their ass off with Brad Albert and those guys. This is not something that hasn't been discussed. But what this is going to do is basically Sony is going to put a bunch of their batteries out, and JLM Energy is going to put their batteries out, and Sunen is going to put theirs, and then Tesla is going to put theirs. None of them are going to be able to talk to each other. And when the Public Service Commission says, hey, utilities, we want you to be able to control the storage, they're going to say, we have no idea on how to do that.
Does it really matter if those market rules are in place, though? I mean, you have a value proposition already. So if the customer wants to self-consume and stop buying expensive grid electricity, who cares whether the systems are talking to each other or that you don't have these sophisticated rules to aggregate systems? Like, what does it matter? I mean, you're still providing value for the customer potentially.
So what's going to happen is we're talking about 14 months away from the expiration of the ITC. What's going to happen is every one of these companies is going to push as hard as they physically can to get a lot of these systems in Hawaii because 15 to 28 cents a kilowatt hour in wholesale prices still work. And some of them are going to actually disconnect from the grid because there's a minimum monthly bill now of $25. And you're going to find that there's going to be more chaos, not less. And it probably then, you know, you might find that NextEra says, I'm out of here. You know, I'm exiting stage left because this is a shit show. And then you end up with, what are Hawaii's options? Like, what exactly are they going to do at that point to figure out how to bring harmony within the electric utility model and the DG model? This rule does not bring harmony. It basically says we're going to issue rough justice. What would have brought harmony is, and I've talked to the commissioner about this, is actually getting the utility to own the battery system. That's what they should have done, was said, hey, we're canceling net metering and we're forcing the utility company to own all these battery systems and give us a plan for how they're going to get all the extra benefits out of it.
Yeah, but I don't think that anything that HECO has ever put together, the commission likes. So I don't know that the commission would allow them to do that even.
Jigger, you sound sort of surprised, though, as if they just came up with this overnight. Like, this phase one has been ongoing for a long time, and they made it very clear that they were just going to be considering net metering and not these holistic market rules. So, like, this rough justice description just doesn't seem apt to me, because we all knew that they were just tackling this one single issue, and that it was a springboard for all these other bigger issues that they plan to actually cover.
Yeah, it was all in their white paper, so it shouldn't be
a
shock.
Yeah, it was. Right. I mean, when you're on the battlefield, you can't actually respond to these types of external shocks on a tit-for-tat basis. The only way to respond to this is through, like, innovation.
And the way to innovate here, and Hawaii Electric has already done a lot of this work, which is around like getting N-phase inverters to provide a better signal, to provide Hawaii Electric's grid operations group an easier way of managing the grid, right? Now tying in energy storage into that stuff. All these pilot programs and all this stuff that they've done needed to become mandatory. And instead of making all those things mandatory, they've basically said, we're going to kick the can down the road because, and I get the fact that they had phase one and phase two, so they had every right to kick the can down the road. But this is going to have very severe negative outcomes. I think what you will find is there will be no standards on the marketplace. A lot of the commercial operators are going to be lost in saying, what is exactly that you want us to do? What communication standards do you want us to to put into our systems? And so you're going to get a lot of quality problems. You're going to have a lot of these grid defection type folks that try to go in and, you know, they may end up providing low quality power to those customers. This is going to create a lot more problems for the commission than they tried to solve for.
Now, I haven't really heard anyone describe it the way that you have, Jigar. And I think, again, there's been this quiet acceptance. And I haven't heard this, aside from TASC, which has a completely different argument than you, I haven't sort of heard this sky is falling worry. But I definitely hear what you're saying about these standards and about opening up this whole set of other problems related to standards as we see more self-consumption systems. So we'll be following that pretty closely.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to affect the 44 states that do have net metering because this is a special situation, but it'll be good to see how they move forward.
The Paris Climate Talks. On November 30th, negotiators and world leaders will gather in Paris and attempt to hash out a global climate deal. A lot hangs in the balance. After the failed UN summit in Copenhagen in 2009, negotiators have been building back up to another grand deal, which some expect will come together this year. There's more to feel positive about this time around. America and China have come to the table with much stronger domestic climate targets. China, India, and others have shown increased willingness to support binding carbon reduction targets. And clean energy technologies have just radically improved in cost, making the solutions easier and cheaper to deploy. But there's a lot to be skeptical about, even cynical. Any binding commitments will take years to develop if they come together at all. And with each passing year, frustration deepens over the slow and cumbersome multilateral negotiations process. And in the pre-Paris talks in Bonn, they showed deep disagreement between countries. So we don't even know if they're going to agree on the final language, which has come together in recent months. What can we expect from this year's negotiations? There's a lot to deal with here. I think a few big issues are this new process that could be agreed upon for binding commitments, and then the funding from developed countries to developing countries, which is a sticky issue. Catherine, are you an optimist or a pessimist when it comes to the climate summit and figuring out the solutions to these problems?
So I'm always an optimist. And I had a chance at this World Economic Forum event that I attended for the last few days in Abu Dhabi. I talked to a lot of people who are, I'm not going to be in Paris, I don't think, but a lot of other people are. I got to talk to a lot of other NGOs. And so one of the lines was, it won't be as bad as Copenhagen. I guess that's optimistic. And then there was some discussion about what happened in Bonn, which was they really expected a short, condensed, focused agreement, 20 pages. And then the developing countries came in, and the developing countries, anyone can just blow up all the negotiations. And, you know, 50 more pages were added. They had to go back to the drawing board and try to figure out.
Was it 50 more?
Yeah, he said like 50 more pages were added. But then they've got it down. Now they've brought it back down again.
So 30, right?
Yeah. So they need to come up with a solutions agenda. And this is like regardless of all the politics. So there's like all this political noise also. And you know, it was Adnan Amin, who's the director general of the International Renewable Energy Agency, was telling me they really need to come up with a really tight solutions agenda with five or six really good things they can do on efficiency and renewables, but really that a lot more is going to get done on these side conversations, that those will be what really drive what happens with large corporations and what happens with the people who can really make the difference. You know, part of the issue is there are no market signals, so people aren't punished for carbon activity. But I am generally optimistic that we'll get something. You had mentioned one of the big issues, which is that they do need to reach a funding agreement that developing countries can agree to.
Totally. Well, one could look at this in both an optimistic and pessimistic way when we consider what happened in Bonn, right? You did have many of the developing countries that caucused on their own, were upset, crafted new language, were upset that the main track started without them. But the agreement didn't blow up. And there was a worry that the developing countries would say, sorry, we don't agree to this. You know, they've tried to set a new target for a degree and a half temperature rise, Celsius, rather than the 2-degree rise that the UN is trying to maintain. And shoot, I mean, if you look at the commitments that will come together at COP, we're looking at a 2.7-degree rise. So we're not even at the 2 degrees yet. But
yeah, and that's Celsius. Countries, that's like almost, that's 4.8 degrees Fahrenheit. That's big.
Well, you guys, I mean, just to back this up for a second, I do want to make sure we acknowledge, you know, how groundbreaking this negotiation is. I think going into Copenhagen, you were basically having Bono and Bill Gates against the deal because they were trying to pit development versus climate change. The dynamic here is that no one is doing that anymore. Everyone now believes that the deployment of climate change solutions is directly in line with development targets because these climate change solutions do not cost a premium, that they actually are the same price or cheaper than what would have been deployed otherwise. So you can have your cake and eat it too. That is the big breakthrough here in Paris that we were not able to achieve in Copenhagen. Copenhagen was always about this is a necessary sacrifice, you know, whereas Paris is more along the lines of this is the largest wealth creation opportunity of our time.
Yes, and I think the corporations have been brought along too. It used to be that the discussions were so separate, and now they're much more interactive, I believe. So yes, I completely agree that large multinational corporations are really stepping up.
Right. So and, now we're arguing about 350 parts per million. We're arguing about 1.5 degrees, all of which is irrelevant to this negotiation because once you actually get this deal done, and it's going to be awful, whatever it ends up being. And everyone's going to say that the commitments that are made will only get us to 2.7 degrees or whatever it is. But once you get this commitment made, then there will be a reinforcing loop. Every corporation that we cover on this podcast is going to be able to more confidently go to those countries and say, hey, you signed up to deploy these kinds of technologies. We offer those kinds of technologies. Let us have a conversation. So much more commerce is going to get done. And those countries then the next year at the next COP will be more confident to increase their commitments.
Yes. And if they get the market signals in place, that will absolutely be the case.
One of the most important elements here, I was reading this piece from Robert Stavins of Harvard. I really like his analysis. And he talked about one of the most important elements being linkage, like how to link up subnational carbon reduction measures with national international targets. And you're walking this really fine line. I guess the big question is, should countries be required to achieve reductions only domestically? Some are pushing for that. Or could they reach out and utilize other jurisdictions under some kind of trading scheme? That's what most people are pushing for, because it would be undoubtedly more expensive to limit reductions to just pure domestic programs. But it's also more complicated to link up all these disparate markets. And so you have to establish these minimum requirements for measuring reductions and tracking them. But Stavins says that, like, if you create too many rules too early, then you run the risk of maybe creating something that's too inflexible as the negotiations evolve after this year. Maybe they have less room to change as policy goals change and markets change. So that to me is kind of an interesting element that we might see evolve as the language comes together.
And that sounds like EPA's Clean Power Plan and exactly what that does.
Well, I guess I come down on both sides on this. I'm pessimistic about what the targets themselves will achieve within the time frame set. But I'm optimistic that a deal will be reached. I don't think this is going to blow up this time.
And we're going to have a podcast. And we're going to have a podcast where we have a guest from Paris during the talks, right?
Yes, that's right. We're working to get Lisa Friedman of E&E News on the line. Hopefully, she can join us from the event. But we will definitely have someone. Hopefully, it's Lisa. She's great. She's been covering the COP proceedings and broad international climate issues for a long time. So she'll be a great guest. Tell me something I don't know. Tell our listeners something they don't know. Jigar, what's your story this week?
So I was reading The Guardian, and they gave us a really interesting article on air conditioning. And so air conditioning and refrigeration is growing so fast that it's forecast to surge 33-fold by 2100 and fairly soon actually exceed our need for heating globally in terms of energy usage.
And it's one of those things where it's like everyone's talking about data centers and other energy hogs, but it's actually air conditioning that is, you know, one of the largest challenges that the world faces in terms of getting efficiency under control.
Catherine, tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, so as of today, we have a new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. He's 45. He was elected with all the Republicans except for 9 Tea Party guys who voted for Daniel Webster. And this is a big deal. He is not ideological from a social perspective, but is very much of a fiscal conservative. He'll be held on a tight leash, but I think he's one of those people who can get things done. I know his chief of staff, and it's just a guy who wants to make sure we get things done, is not an ideologue. And Boehner was able to, before leaving, cut a budget deal and a debt limit deal so the United States government will keep running and won't default, which are things that the Tea Party is upset about, but which I think generally are good ideas.
I want to know what kind of begging went on behind the scenes to get him to actually take the job.
Yeah, I heard he had a list. It was like the Magna Carta. Like, here is the deal, guys.
Yeah, and honestly, though, there's a huge meme on Twitter about this, and I fully agree. Like, his list, if a woman had to, like, you know, ask for that list, they would have been derided. But, like, he was sort of, like, you know, championed as a family man for wanting to spend time with his kids on the weekends and all sorts of other crap.
Yeah,
well, I think a lot of groups were up. Yeah, I think a lot of groups were upset because he said that he demanded family time and that he wouldn't travel as much as previous speakers to go raise money, but that he's supported bills that cut funding for programs for, like, daycare programs and other family initiatives. So I know that there was a big kerfluffle about that. I want to talk about a report really quickly that GTM Research just came out with. We've all come to accept that solar panels are mostly commodities now, right? Differentiated mostly by price. But that may not be fully true right now. One of our GTM senior solar analysts, Mohit Anand, has a new report out looking at manufacturing facilities being sited around the world. And he found that as the finances of these companies improve, leading manufacturers are building new facilities in areas with really strong demand, obviously a lot in Asia. And they're not necessarily looking at the lowest input costs, which is, that's of course really important, but they're considering domestic demand. He writes this, quote, "To an extent, the healthier solar market has freed PV modules from the commodity price cycle. The market now has an appetite for a value proposition that goes beyond price." So I don't think we want to overplay this trend because pricing is still crucial, but it's no longer perhaps the dominant consideration when building new capacity. Thanks for listening to the show. All our back episodes can be found at greentechmedia.com/podcast. And of course, at SoundCloud and iTunes. If you don't use either of those, there are some great apps out there. Just grab our RSS feed at Green Tech Media and you can plug us into the app of your choice. It's very simple. Thank you also to Huawei Technologies for sponsoring this show. Find out more about how the company is connecting the world and connecting the solar industry at Huawei.com, Huawei.com. Send us a note if you have questions or comments. We can be reached at podcasts@greentechmedia.com. And if you want a free one-day trial to GTM Squared, email squared@greentechmedia.com. Catherine, have a great end of your week and weekend.
I will. I'm glad daylight savings is ending so that when I walk my dog in the morning, it won't be so dark.
Jigger, enjoy the rest of your week with your new son.
Thank you. I'm going to.
Excellent. Well, with Catherine Hamilton and Jigar Shah, I'm Stephen Lacey, and we are The Energy Gang, a production of greentechmedia.com. We'll catch you next week.